I plan to spend the night unwinding with Netflix, some wine, and working on my sketches. My job had other plans. I worked at a tailor shop, and we had more orders than we could handle. So the owner and I had been taking some orders home to finish to try and catch up. This night was one of those. I got home from work, sat at my sewing machine, and worked some more. I did a couple of hours before I decided to stop and start with my original plan. I grabbed some Kraft mac and cheese from my cabinet and started boiling water. While I waited for the water to boil, I meandered over to my desk to assess my sketches from last night. I was creating a portfolio to apply to a fashion school in New York City. I felt like I was rotting away in this small town, and I think I had the vision to really go somewhere. I turned on the TV to Netflix to watch some mind-numbing docu-series while I worked on my sketches. I started scrolling through my options when someone knocked on my door. Weird, I thought. I wasn't expecting anyone, and my neighbors never bothered me. I looked through the peephole on my door and saw no one. So I opened the door and peered out. Still, there was no one to be found. On my doorstep, someone left takeout. I looked around one more time. Someone must have delivered to the wrong door, I thought. I snatched up the takeout before someone else could claim it as theirs. This would beat the mac and cheese I was making. I turned off the stove and dumped the water in the sink. I opened up the bags to find a feast. There was fried rice, chow mein, beef and broccoli, a chicken dish, and some egg rolls. I was thrilled. All that food would last me days, and I could never eat out because it was so expensive. I made up a plate and sat down at my desk with a view of the TV. I scarfed it down. You would have thought I hadn't eaten in days by the way I inhaled the fried rice. With a full stomach, I cleaned my few dishes and sat down to get to work. A Netflix docuseries about some online cult droned on in the background while I worked designing garments worthy of the Met Gala. I was barely into the first episode when I started feeling sleepy. The clock read 7:30 p.m., so it was still early, way too early to go to bed just yet, and I hadn't even finished one sketch. I tried to stay awake, but soon enough, my eyes were closed and my head was on my desk. I fell asleep to a girl giving her account of how a cult leader forced her into an abusive relationship. I woke with a start. I was sitting up in a chair, but I wasn't in my apartment. I was in a poorly lit room with my arms tied behind a chair. I looked around, and the only lights illuminated brilliant works of art. There were some abstract pieces and portraits. It looked like one was an attempt at a landscape, but the painter got frustrated and took it in a more abstract route. My heart was racing. I pulled and wiggled, trying to loosen the knot around my wrists, but it didn't budge. My mind raced. How did I end up here? Where am I? How did someone get into my apartment and move me? Behind me, I heard someone breathing heavily and brush strokes on a canvas. "Hello?" I yelled out. A paintbrush clattered on the floor.
"Oh, thank God, you're awake, finally," a man's voice said.
I heard his footsteps come closer and closer until he came up around me.
"Stephen Crawley,"
he said, reaching out his hand. He laughed.
"Oh, right. A bit tied up?
What's going on?"
"I'm Stephen Crawley,"
he said again. I looked around. "Okay, I'm Hank. What's going on?"
"Haven't you heard of me?"
Stephen started getting frustrated. "No," I said.
"Me? The brilliant Stephen Crawley? The ingenious painter exploring how true art can only be found through true suffering?"
"Not ringing any bells. But I'm not up on painters. Try not to take it personally," I said. His face turned red.
"Oh, but I do take it personally.
What am I doing here?"
"You're here to help,"
he said with an unsettling smile.
"You don't know me,
But I know you, Hank O'Brien. In fact, you tailored these pants.
He posed a few different ways for me to see.
Your boss showed me some of your sketches, and I must admit, while I'm not a fashion man, I was impressed.
Thank you, I said. So,
did you kidnap me?
I was more confused than anything. Steven struck me as a proud artist, but not a killing madman. I didn't understand why he would go through the trouble of kidnapping me.
Good! Yes!
His anger subsided some.
Do you know why you're here?
No, I asked you, but you told me your name instead. I wasn't sure if I was in danger, or if he just wanted someone to look at his art. His face grew red again at my response. He let out a frustrated yell.
Have you heard about the string of missing people in the news?
I shook my head. I don't really watch the news much. His face grew redder.
Well, there's a string of missing artists. Look around.
I looked around, but all I saw was his art and him. I shrugged. I'm not sure what reaction you're hoping for here. Can you untie me? I think the ropes are cutting off my circulation. He yelled again.
No! You're here to help me complete my mission. Look around. Each piece was inspired by a young, aspiring artist like yourself.
He walked to a portrait of a young woman.
It all started with Scarlett. I met her at a coffee shop she worked at. She did these most brilliant sketches. She did one of me, and I have never had someone capture me like her.
He walked to the next piece, an abstract one.
Then there was Cam. He did glass sculptures. He mostly wasted his talent creating bongs and pipes, but he showed me the most beautiful dolphin statue he did once when bored.
I was confused where he was going with this. So, you want me to help you inspire a painting?
Yes, exactly! You see, I believe true art is only born from suffering. Scarlett started drawing after her stepfather did unspeakable things. That was her suffering. Cam turned to glass blowing to get away from his messed up home. You turned to fashion because of bullying, correct? How do you know that?
I do my research.
He winked.
In my life, I have had no such suffering. I was born into a loving, financially secure family, but I desire greatness. I want to be remembered as a daring artist. So I must create my own suffering. I find other great artists, and from their pain, I create masterpieces. Wouldn't you say I've created some genius works?
Yeah, they're impressive. So, do you just want to hear about my story and get inspired from that? Steven shook his head and turned my chair to face the canvas he was working on.
This piece will be forged through your suffering.
All of his paintings were done in red and black paint. There was only black paint so far on this one. I looked around. And to the right of his canvas was a desk with brushes and knives. My heart began to pound in my chest. What did he need knives for? I strained my neck, trying to see how dark a red he used in his other paintings. Can you elaborate on my suffering? Steven smiled at me and walked over to his workstation. He started picking up different sized knives.
With Scarlett, we used a small scalpel to make deep cuts on her beautiful face. I held up a mirror so she had to watch. With Cam,
Steven picked up the bigger knife.
We cut off each of his fingers.
A lump in my throat formed. Steven continued.
And from their blood, masterpieces were born. And now, it's your turn.
Steven picked up a big needle with thick, dark thread. I started pulling at the rope behind me with vigor now. I need to keep him talking, I thought. What are you going to do with me?
I'm going to sew your mouth shut. And I guess I'll do your fingers next.
I started to feel the rope loosen.
keep him talking,
I reminded myself.
Have you really never been through anything? Like, your whole life has been peachy? My parents never approved of my art.
Steven started going on about his parents' negligence in fostering his art. I asked questions as I continued to loosen the ropes more and more until, finally, my hand was free. I jumped out of the chair. Steven started approaching, and I picked up the chair and threw it at him. I started running away, desperate for an exit. There had to be a door around here somewhere. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw a window. I ran up to it, opened it, and crawled out. The night air felt refreshing on my skin.
Get back here!
Steven yelled, running after me. Before he reached the window, I was off. I ran to the nearest road and waited for a car to stop. When someone finally did, I asked them to take me to a police station. I explained everything to the cops, and they sped over to Steven's warehouse. There, they found multiple pieces of art, but Steven was nowhere to be found. They tested the paintings, and the DNA matched a few missing person reports. They did a manhunt for Steven, but it's like he vanished into thin air. They talked to his parents, but they said they hadn't talked to him in years. As for me, I moved. I'm still working on applying to art school. Now I want to get out of this town even more than I did before. Being a travel nurse wasn't easy. Well, being any type of nurse wasn't easy, with the long, exhausting hours, back-to-back shifts, mentality-draining situations, and the regular high stakes of the job. Adding constant travel and lack of routine to that mix wasn't for everyone. I worked for 5 years as a regular nurse in Phoenix until I took the plunge and became a travel nurse. The road, until I got accustomed to the hurdles of the job, was extremely challenging, and I even considered giving up and going back home many times. But for someone that prioritizes flexibility and higher pay, being a travel nurse was the best thing for me. My agency sent me a 6-week contract in rural Arizona with an amazing net pay per week and a high stipend, and it was perfectly located 45 minutes away from my parents' house, so I could pocket the stipend money by not having to pay for housing or accommodations. Also, I would get to spend the days I wasn't working with my parents, just enjoying their company. My mom had been vibrating with excitement since I made the call, letting her know I was heading their way. It was a win-win. While driving through the 89 towards Flagstaff, the low gas signal on my dashboard lit up, and I fixed my eyes on the road for the first gas station nearby. One didn't appear for the next 10 miles or so, and even then, it was such a small place, I briefly wondered if it was even working to begin with. But the light of the convenience store was the only bright thing in the night, so I figured it was worth a shot. Besides, there was another car by the air station. So I parked parallel to one pump and got out to fill my tank. Lord knew it was almost empty. Except the first one wasn't working. Or the second. But the third one was the charm. And the pump was on and seemed in order. When I went to take my card, however, it wouldn't budge. The thing was completely stuck inside the machine, and no amount of pulling or wiggling or a combination of both would get it out. I looked towards the big glass window of the convenience store, but didn't see anyone inside. The lights were still on, including the one of a small refrigerator in the back, so I knew someone had to be there, somewhere. Frustrated, I pressed the help button on the pump and waited for a response. Not even 10 seconds later, I heard a male voice over the intercom. Yes? When I looked back at the glass window, there was a clerk standing behind the counter, looking mighty annoyed with me. Ignoring the fact that he wasn't there less than a minute ago, I pushed the button again so he could hear me. Hi, my card got stuck in the machine. Can you help?
If you hold the exit button and pull the card, it should come out, ma'am.
I did as he instructed, but it was still stuck.
Well, it didn't.
I couldn't understand why the guy just wouldn't come out. I waved at him and motioned towards the pump, but he still didn't move, not even an inch.
Can't you just come here and help, please?
After much trouble, I watched as the guy finally rounded the corner of the balcony and made his way outside towards me. I couldn't say he was a creepy-looking guy, but I couldn't say he wasn't either. There was just something about him that made you uneasy. Maybe his face was too gaunt, or his body too lanky. I didn't know. But he definitely gave me the proverbial heebie-jeebies the whole time he stood beside me, basically opening the machine to get my card out. He would steal glances at me now and then, that I returned with uncomfortable half-smiles. After my card was finally freed, that pump could no longer be used, so he told me to go inside and pay in cash. And it was pure luck I still had any on me. We went in, and as he was counting the change, I purposefully didn't look at him. But I could feel that he was staring at me the whole time. I couldn't wait to be out of there and far away from this creep. He handed me the cash, his cold, twitchy finger sliding against mine, and I put it in my pocket without even checking it. I just wanted out. As I turned around, my eyes quickly landed on that big convex mirror most convenience stores have. And that was when I saw it. Right by the corner, there was someone, a girl maybe, with their hands and feet bound. A cold shiver went over my whole body, from head to toe. I suddenly found myself frozen in place, unable to move, not even a single muscle. Who was that person? What were they doing there? Did the clerk kidnap them? Then, I remembered the car already parked outside when I arrived, and my mind put the two and two together. The person under the balcony had to be the owner of the car. Something wrong? His voice called my attention back, and I realized I probably stood there for way too long. I had to say something, anything, so he wouldn't suspect I'd seen it. My solution was to ask for a pack of cigarettes, and after he gave it to me, I nearly flew out of there. Once inside my car and about a mile away from the gas station, I finally allowed myself to breathe. My hands were shaking so much I feared they would turn the wheel in a different direction. I kept driving, but my mind was still focused on the person under the balcony. I couldn't leave them there, alone and scared. What if he killed the person? He could. No one kidnapped another person or held them hostage if they weren't ready for some serious violence. Damn, I had to get back there. Cursing my lack of judgment, I stopped the car on the side of the road, got my lantern and my emergency nursing kit, my phone, and I went walking into the night, headed back to the gas station. I was sensible enough to call 911 and report the emergency, but we were in the middle of nowhere. God only knew how long it would take them to get there. I had to act fast. When I spotted the faint light of the convenience store, I ducked down to avoid being seen. The car by the air station was unlocked, keys still in the ignition. And since it was outside the range of the convenience store's window, I risked opening it. The documents inside the glove compartment told me it belonged to an Anne Marie Toombs, 21, from California. God, she was so young, barely even an adult yet. I had to be smart about it, otherwise we would both end up in trouble, not just her. As I tried to come up with a game plan to successfully save someone from captivity, a desperate, pain-filled screech broke into the night. He was hurting her. There was no doubt about it. My brain immediately went into the zone. The same place it went in a packed hospital, with dozens of people pulling at us nurses from all directions, begging for help. Clutching at my emergency bag, I rounded the corner, staying close to the wall, looking for another point of entry. Sadly, I couldn't find any back entrance, so the only way in was through the front door. And the one thing I remembered about it was how it creaked when it opened. Okay, so there was no way of getting in without being heard. That made things difficult, not to say nearly impossible. Still, what choice did I have? Wasn't like I could... The car! I remembered noticing that Anne's car was one of those models that had a panic button on the key fob. I went back towards it, grabbed the key fob, and walked towards the convenience store, careful to remain hidden.
The alarm rang incredibly loud into the quiet night, and it didn't take long until the clerk was fumbling outside to check. Without missing a beat, I took that opportunity to get inside, praying that the noise of the alarm would be enough to mask the door's noise. Once inside, the place was eerily calm. My footsteps rang loud in my ears as I made my way towards a dark corridor that led to three other doors. I found her in the last one, marked maintenance room. Something I didn't notice before was that a dark cloth covered her eyes. So when she heard me getting in, her first instinct was to scream and beg for me to let her go. I crouched beside her in an instant, covering her mouth.
"Shh, I'm here to help you, Anne,"
I whispered, still paying attention to the noise outside from the alarm.
"I'll get you out of here, I promise."
Briefly assessing her for injuries was a mistake, because she looked terrible. Bruises on top of one another, many cuts, all in different stages of healing. It was clear that she'd been tortured, by the looks of it, for at least a few days. I grabbed the shears from my emergency kit and cut the rope from her feet. Taken aback when removing the tight material also took bits of her skin with it. She wouldn't make it one step out of there without some very strong painkiller, so I quickly prepared a syringe with medication to give it to her. In my hyper-focused state, I failed to notice that the alarm outside had stopped, and that was a big mistake. Next thing I knew, a vicious grip on my hair dragged me away from Anne and towards the opposite wall, slamming me against it. The pain was sharp, agonizing, and spread all over my body in a quick wave. I realized then that the sharp remaining part of a metal pipe had briefly impaled my arm on impact. Now I was the one who needed a very strong painkiller. I had no time to get my bearings because the clerk caught up to me quickly, holding me by the neck, alternating between choking me and hitting my head against the tiles. The syringe fell just inches away from my hand, but it might as well be miles away. I couldn't reach it. My vision was already fading along the edges, and the last image I would ever see was the snarling, deformed face of the clerk, killing me. I heard a desperate grunt, followed by a loud scream, and I opened my eyes to find that Anne, even with her hands still bound and incredibly weak, managed to stab the clerk's inner thigh with my shears. Immediately, he started bleeding profusely. If it sliced through a major artery, it could be enough to incapacitate him. Still, I didn't want to take any chances. As he writhed on the floor, clearly in agony, I saw my opportunity. I straddled his torso, grabbed the syringe from the floor, and then with both hands and using all my strength, stabbed him with it. Underneath me, his body twisted like a bolt of electricity zapped him. And then he stopped moving completely. The syringe went right into the middle of his left, still sticking out like a weird flagpole. The sight was absurd enough it almost made me laugh. Anne and I stared at each other in total disbelief. Somehow, we'd made it. We were alive. Then, we had to nearly drag ourselves towards the front door and wait for the police. They couldn't come soon enough. One thing was certain. I would think twice, three times even, before stopping at a gas station in the middle of nowhere.
Rain lashed at the car's windshield, creating a thick veil of mist across the screen. Even with the windscreen wipers on full, it barely cleared one sheet of rain before another took its place, obscuring the road ahead. It was late, sometime after midnight, and the roads were empty. I had stayed behind at work to get some documents finished before the weekend, and time had completely slipped away from me. I was tired and desperate to get home, but I still had another 30 minutes to drive, and the rain didn't seem to be letting up. If anything, it was getting heavier, thudding against the roof of the car like tiny missiles. I couldn't keep driving in this. It was too dangerous. I kept going for another 5 minutes before the tires finally skidded on the slick road, and I decided it wasn't safe to keep going. I was on a backcountry road and nothing but trees surrounded me for miles, until I saw a sign up ahead for an off-road motel. I didn't plan on sticking around for long, just until the rain let up, but maybe they'd let me stay inside and grab a hot drink for a while. If not, at least there'd be somewhere to park my car for a bit. The car plugged along for the last mile until the motel came into sight, a little ways back from the main road. It was an old-fashioned-looking building, gray and washed out beneath the stormy dusk. There were only a couple of other cars parked up, so I clumsily pulled into one of the spaces and killed the engine. Sitting in silence, I listened to the pounding echo of the rain on the windows and bonnet. It was really coming down out there. Part of me didn't want to get out of the car, but I didn't want to be sitting out here in the dark either. I'd parked fairly close to the reception building, so I just had to run a short distance and I'd be warm and sheltered. Most places like this had a vending machine for hot drinks too, so maybe I'd be lucky enough to get a decent cup of coffee to keep me awake. I waited for a brief lull in the downpour before throwing open my car door and pelting across the parking lot towards the reception building. It didn't take long for the rain to soak through my clothes, and I wondered if I'd been better off just staying in the car, but it was too late to regret it now. I wrung the water out of my clothes and pushed through the door to the motel's reception. Inside was as old and grimy looking as the exterior, and I was disappointed to see no vending machine in sight. Maybe I'd been wrong about stopping. I should have just kept driving. A reception desk and a couple of tatty-looking chairs were the only furniture filling the small area. The lights were faulty, flickering at the edges of my vision, and there was nobody at the desk. The place might have seemed abandoned if not for the two cars outside. There had to be someone here. With a sigh, I turned around, intending to run back to my car when a voice spoke behind me. "Can I help you?" I gave a start, my heart lurching into my throat. I turned around to see a tall, gangly-looking man standing at the reception desk. Had he been there before? Surely there was no way I would have missed seeing someone like him. He had greasy black hair and dark hooded eyes that watched me with a strange gleam.
Sorry to bother you, I said, clearing my throat. I was just looking for somewhere to get out of the rain. Maybe get a hot drink?
The man studied me carefully across the room. He wore a white button shirt that was stained around the collar and a pair of black pants that looked a size too big for him. Everything about him screamed scruffy, but it was his eyes that bothered me the most. Dark and deep-set, watching me like a predator.
"I can offer you a room," he said, his voice low, crackly like static.
No, that's okay, I said quickly. Maybe I could just stay here until the rain slows down. As soon as I said those words, I regretted it. Did I really want to stay here? In this grimy old motel with this strange man looking at me like that? Even as a man, he was giving me the serious creeps. The man inclined his head slowly. He said, and I realized he was agreeing to let me stay.
Thanks, I said,
walking over to one of the chairs and sitting down. Outside, a peal of thunder cracked across the sky like a whip, making me jump. Thunder didn't usually scare me, but maybe I was more on edge than usual. I could still feel the man watching me across the room, making me shuffle uncomfortably.
So, you get much business out here? I asked, trying to break the silence and maybe make him do something other than just stare.
Enough, he answered shortly.
I shifted my feet. Overhead, the lights flickered off and on again, sending shadows scuttling across the room. When I looked up, the man had moved closer, stepping out from behind the reception desk. I swallowed thickly. Now that he was closer, I could smell something on him. Sweat, maybe, or grime? But also something else, something sharp and metallic. I flicked a glance towards him, and my gaze snagged something on his shirt. Something dark splashed on the white material. I felt my stomach twinge, but forced myself to think rationally. So what if he had some blood on his shirt? Maybe he cut himself or had a nosebleed. It wasn't that strange.
So why is he creeping closer like that? Another voice whispered in the back of my head. And looking at you like that. I cleared my throat again. Sweat dribbled down the back of my neck. I stood up suddenly, which seemed to startle the man. He quickly recovered, looking at me curiously. He was much closer than before, almost close enough to touch me. You know, I think the rain seems to be slowing down, I said, marching towards the door. I reached for the handle and gasped when it wouldn't open. No matter how much I tugged on the door, it wouldn't budge. How was it locked? I hadn't seen the man go anywhere near the door to lock it. What seems to be the matter? The man asked from behind me, smugness dripping from his voice. Have you decided to stay after all? What the hell? Oh, open the door, I snarled, turning round to face him again. The man shrugged. You know, it's dangerous driving in a storm. You really, really should stay. I shook my head and turned back to the door, frantically tugging at the handle and slamming my fists on the glass. But of course, nobody was out there to help me. And even if there was, nobody would hear me over the sound of the pouring rain. My heart pounded a frantic rhythm against my ribs as the man approached. He moved with a predatory grace, each step silent despite the drumming of the rain on the roof. Each second stretched into an eternity. The heavy air thick with the metallic tang of fear and something else I couldn't place. Just as he reached me, a deafening crack of thunder split the sky, plunging the room into darkness. In the momentary blackout, a sharp object pressed against my neck, sending a jolt of terror through me. Don't move, a low voice rasped in my ear, sending shivers down my spine. This won't hurt if you cooperate. He guided me towards a single lit candle on the desk, its flickering flame casting grotesque shadows against the wall. My eyes darted around the room, searching for an escape, but the door remained stubbornly locked. What do you want? I whispered, my voice barely audible above the storm's fury. He chuckled, a dry, humorless sound. A little company. He leaned closer, the warmth of his breath tickling my ear, his hand rough and calloused brushing against me. To my surprise, it wasn't a violent gesture, but a hesitant touch, almost questioning. Under the flickering candlelight, I saw his eyes properly for the first time. They weren't cold and calculating as I had initially thought, but filled with a deep sadness and a hint of fear. The thought sparked a flicker of something within me, a strange mix of fear and morbid curiosity. As the storm raged outside, the room inside became a scene of a bizarre dance. He, the predator, hesitant and unsure, and me, the prey, fighting a primal urge to submit to the raw, animalistic tension in the air. Our eyes locked, and in that moment I understood. He wasn't the monster I'd envisioned. He was a man, a broken one, seeking solace in the storm's chaos, just like me. The line between predator and prey blurred. As the candle flickered and died, plunging us into darkness, I met his touch halfway, drawn by a force I couldn't explain. The storm outside continued its relentless assault. But in the quiet darkness of the motel room, a different kind of storm brewed. A storm of desperate need and unexpected connection. It was a storm of survival, forged in the crucible of fear, with an ending as unpredictable as the weather that had brought us together.
It all started with the ketchup. I never thought a condiment could be the catalyst for the darkest chapter of my life, but here I was, staring at the remnants of our dinner with a hollow feeling in my chest. The evening began, innocuously enough, just another Thursday night with burgers sizzling on the grill and the promise of a relaxed family meal. But my husband, Ethan, had a knack for turning the mundane into the monstrous. Where's the ketchup? I asked, searching through the fridge. Ethan didn't look up from his plate.
There wasn't much left, so I threw it out. My daughter Lily and I exchanged a glance. We both loved ketchup on our burgers. Annoyed, I muttered under my breath, "It'll taste a lot better with ketchup." Ethan's head snapped up. "You completely ruined the night! I deserve so much better than you!" His words stung like a slap. There was no humor in his tone, no hint of jest, just cold, hard truth. The room fell silent, the tension thick enough to cut with a knife. I forced a smile, hoping to defuse the situation.
"It's just ketchup, Ethan. No big deal."
But it was a big deal. To him, it always was. Ethan thrived on control, and tonight I had challenged it, however inadvertently. The rest of the meal passed in silence, and I found myself retreating to the bedroom as soon as I could. I needed space to think, to process his words. Our marriage had been unraveling for months, but tonight felt like the breaking point. Ethan's anger simmered beneath the surface, a constant undercurrent that threatened to drag us both under. I lay in bed, staring at the ceiling, my mind racing with thoughts of escape. The following day, I decided to take Lily to the park, hoping a change of scenery would help clear my mind. The fresh air did little to soothe my anxiety. I found myself watching other families, envying their apparent happiness and ease. How had things gone so wrong? When we returned home, Ethan was waiting for us, his expression unreadable. "We need to talk," he said. I nodded, my stomach knotting with dread. We sat in the living room, Lily playing quietly in the corner, oblivious to the storm brewing between her parents. "I'm sorry about last night," Ethan began, his voice oddly calm. "I overreacted." I waited, sensing there was more to come. "But you need to understand, Claire. I have certain expectations. If you can't meet them, maybe you're right. Maybe we should go our separate ways." The threat hung in the air, heavy and suffocating. I wanted to scream, to fight back, but I knew it would only make things worse. Instead, I nodded, forcing myself to stay composed. "I'll do better," I promised, hating myself for the words. Days turned into weeks, and I found myself walking on eggshells, terrified of triggering another outburst. Ethan's mood swings became more frequent, his temper more volatile. I started keeping a journal, documenting every incident, every insult, hoping it would help me make sense of the chaos. One night, as I was writing, I heard a noise outside. Peering through the window, I saw Ethan standing by the garage talking to someone. The shadows obscured their features, but I could tell it was a woman. My heart pounded in my chest as I strained to hear their conversation. "She's starting to break," Ethan said, low and conspiratorial. "Good," the woman replied. "It needs to happen soon." I recoiled, my mind racing with questions. Who was she? What were they planning? I knew I couldn't confront Ethan directly. I needed proof. The next day, I installed a small camera in the garage, hoping to catch them in the act. I spent the evening anxiously watching the footage, but nothing happened. It wasn't until the following night that I finally got my answer. Ethan and the woman stood close, their faces illuminated by the dim light. "Claire's getting suspicious," Ethan said, his tone urgent. "Then we need to accelerate the plan," the woman replied. "She can't know about the money." "Money? What money?" My mind raced, piecing together the fragments of their conversation. Ethan had always been secretive about our finances, but I had never suspected anything like this. The next morning, I took a day off work and went to the bank, requesting a detailed statement of our accounts. What I found left me reeling. Large sums of money had been transferred to an unknown account, and the transactions were all recent.
I confronted Ethan that evening, unable to contain my anger any longer.
What is this?
I demanded, shoving the bank statement in his face. His eyes narrowed, and for a moment I saw a flash of fear. You shouldn't have done that, Claire. Before I could react, he lunged at me, knocking the wind out of me as we crashed to the floor.
You should have just stayed quiet,
he hissed, his hands tightening around my throat. In that moment, something inside me snapped. I fought back with everything I had, clawing at his face, kicking, biting. I managed to break free, scrambling to my feet and grabbing the nearest object, a heavy lamp. I swung it with all my strength, connecting with his head. Ethan crumpled to the ground unconscious. I stood there, panting, staring at his motionless body. What had I done? Panic surged through me as I grabbed Lily and fled the house, driving aimlessly until I found myself at a police station. The officers listened patiently as I recounted everything: the abuse, the secret meetings, the stolen money. They assured me I had done the right thing, but I couldn't shake the feeling of dread. What if Ethan woke up? What if he came after us? Days turned into weeks, and I struggled to rebuild my life. The police arrested Ethan, and he was charged with fraud and assault. The woman, his accomplice, turned out to be a former lover, and together they had been siphoning money from our accounts, planning to disappear and leave me with nothing. But the damage was done. I couldn't sleep, couldn't eat. Every noise made me jump. Every shadow sent me into a panic. I had survived, but at what cost? One night, as I lay in bed, I heard a familiar noise outside. My heart raced as I crept to the window, peering into the darkness. There, standing by the garage, was Ethan. He looked up, his eyes meeting mine, and smiled. You should have stayed quiet, Claire. I stumbled back, my mind reeling. How could this be? He was in jail. I had seen him taken away. But as I turned to run, I felt his hand on my shoulder, his breath hot on my neck. You can never escape me, he whispered. I woke up screaming, drenched in sweat. It had been a dream, a nightmare. But as I lay there, trembling, I realized the truth. Ethan might be gone, but he would haunt me forever, a specter of the life I had once known. The darkness he brought into my world would never truly leave. And in the silence of the night, I could still hear his voice echoing in my mind. You should have stayed quiet. And I knew, deep down, that no matter where I went, no matter how far I ran, the nightmare would always be just one step behind me.
Over a month ago, I went to Idaho to meet my boyfriend Robbie's family for the first time. Robbie had grown up in a really small town, though he didn't act like it at all. He acted like all our other city friends, so when he invited me, I assumed his hometown would be a mid-sized city with plenty to do. I was very wrong. The whole town had just a couple thousand people, and it was also spread out with endless flat fields. I always loved traveling, but this was the first place I'd visited that genuinely creeped me out. As we drove through the town's one main road, Robbie excitedly gave me a tour of everything we passed. I couldn't believe it. He was actually excited to be back here. He wasn't embarrassed or anything. We parked in front of his childhood home, and his parents ran out to greet us. They seemed like really nice, warm people. Robbie had already told them a lot about me, so they asked me a bunch of questions about my work and my family. It was very pleasant. After settling in, I realized that I had forgot to bring my allergy medication. I'm extremely allergic to cats, and Robbie's mom Catherine had 3 cats. I asked Catherine if she had any medicine I could borrow, but she told me that I'd have to run to the store. That's when I found out that everyone in this town shopped exclusively at Walmart. That's why they called it the store. It was literally the only store in the area. I asked Robbie to go with me, but he was so excited to catch up with his parents. I ended up taking his car and driving myself there. I know it's weird to admit, but even though I was in my late 20s, I'd never actually been in a Walmart before. I always preferred places like Trader Joe's and Whole Foods instead. I thought of Walmart as the kind of place that poor people went to. But I was pleasantly surprised when I entered. It was a modern, clean building with pretty much everything a person would need. The old woman who greeted me seemed really nice, and the cashiers and customers all smiled when they saw me. I guess they didn't see a lot of new faces. I went to the pharmacy section and got the medicine I needed. Then I got some wine to bring back to Robbie's parents. As I was checking out, the cashier engaged in a bit of small talk. She asked about what brought me to Idaho. I told them I was meeting my in-laws for the first time. She smiled, welcoming me to the area. Then I mentioned Robbie's name, and the woman's expression instantly hardened. "You're staying with the Carpenters?" she asked. "Yeah," I said. "Catherine and Bob Carpenter. I'm dating their son." The woman looked around the room, making sure that no one heard me. Then, she printed out my receipt and wrote something on it before she placed it in one of my bags. I thanked her and left. When I got back in the car, I pulled out my receipt to see what she'd written. It was a single sentence at the bottom of the paper. "They're in a cult." As I drove back to Robbie's house, I had no idea what to do. Was this some kind of small-town joke that locals played on outsiders? Or was she serious? I didn't know my in-laws well enough to ask them, but I trusted Robbie enough to talk to him about it. I parked my car and walked inside with my medicine and wine. Catherine greeted me at the door, saying that I was just in time for brunch. Robbie and his dad were already sitting at the table. They looked up and smiled at me. With a note still on my mind, I started to see the house in a new light. The walls were covered with family photos, but there were framed paintings of weird symbols. A huge painting just above the dinner table showed a witch being burnt at the stake. The whole place suddenly seemed cultish. I sat down at the table, pretending that everything was okay. I guess I didn't do a good job, though, because Robbie asked me what was wrong. His parents both stared at me, waiting for an answer. I asked Robbie if I could talk to him in private. He laughed and said, "Sure, after we eat." The food looked pretty normal, but if it were poisoned or something, I wouldn't be able to tell. My plate was already filled with food. Just in case, I turned to Robbie and asked, "Actually, I know this is weird, but can we switch places? It looks like yours has more mashed potatoes." Catherine reached for the bowl of potatoes, ready to serve me more, but I ignored her and swapped my plate for Robbie's. If they wanted to poison me, I wasn't going to take any chances. Robbie gave me a strange look, but he didn't say anything. When he started eating from the plate that was originally meant for me, I knew that there wasn't any poison involved. I had just let the cashier's weird warning go to my head. I started eating too. Everything tasted normal. Then Catherine stood up, holding up her champagne. "Let's have a toast." I started to worry that there was something wrong with my drink. We clinked glasses and drank at the same time, but I kept my lips closed so that I didn't swallow anything. Robbie's parents looked at me suspiciously, but they didn't say anything. After the meal was over, I helped Catherine clean up. Then I pulled Robbie aside and showed him what the cashier had written. I thought he would laugh and say it was all some small town joke. That's what I hoped would happen. Instead, he got this really disappointed look and said, "Well, crap, you caught us." Then he shouted for his parents to enter in the room. They hurried in. "What is it, son?" his father asked. "She knows," he told them. Then he looked right at me. This should have been easy. All he had to do was drink your champagne and everything would be easy. But no, you had to ask questions. "What's going on?" Before Robbie could answer, his parents raced forward and grabbed my arms to hold me still. Then Robbie left for the kitchen. He came back with another glass of champagne. "I'm sorry, babe, it's not your fault. But we need to fill our sacrifice quota for the season. Just open up your mouth and it'll be fast." He pushed the glass against my lips and tried to pour it into my mouth. He pinched my nose so that I couldn't breathe, and his parents held me so hard that I couldn't twist out of the way. "Just drink it," he screamed into my face. He never talked to me like that before. All the time we'd spent together, it was all a lie. He was never really my boyfriend. He was just playing a long con, lowering my defenses so he could take me back to his hometown and sacrifice me to whatever messed up religion they found. I opened up my mouth to breathe, and that's when he started pouring the champagne down my throat. It filled my mouth, but I refused to swallow. I started choking. His parents squeezed me tighter. My choking got worse, and Robbie pulled the glass away from my mouth. I spat out everything I could. Then he tried again, this time more forcefully. I guess the fear of death took over me. I couldn't move my body, so I slammed my head forward, knocking the glass out of his hand. It shattered on the floor, spilling the champagne onto the carpet. His parents, surprised by my sudden movement, loosened their grip. I shoved them out of the way and raced for the door. As they chased after me, I ran to Robbie's car and locked myself inside. Thankfully, I still had Robbie's keys in my pocket. All three of them pounded on the car door, screaming for me to come out. I turned on the ignition and drove out of there. Thanks to Robbie's quick tour of the town, I remembered where the police station was. I drove straight there, ready to report the attempted poisoning. A policeman greeted me, but I noticed the same symbols on his office wall that were in Robbie's house. He was part of the cult too. I guess a lot of the town was. That was why the cashier had to write me a note instead of telling me directly. She didn't know who was listening in. The policeman asked me what was wrong. I told him never mind, and then I left. I drove all the way back to Boise, the nearest big city, where I went to a real police station to report what happened. The cop wrote everything down and said he'd look into it. I'm still waiting for answers. It's been over a month and I haven't heard anything from Robbie or his family. I'm in constant fear that they'll come after me to finish their sacrifice. But if they do, I'm going to be ready.
My name is Linda. I'm a 52-year-old mother of two and a grandmother of one. I've lived a wonderful, fulfilling life. But when my husband Daniel passed away unexpectedly, I really started to struggle with money. I never had a real job before. I was always a stay-at-home mother. But without Daniel's paycheck, I needed to find something. I started working at the Target near my house. It felt weird going from the housewife who shopped there all the time to the red-coated lady behind the counter. But it wasn't a bad job. And when I saw my friends and neighbors waiting in my line, I never felt self-conscious. One night, I was the only cashier there. It was a little less than a half hour before closing. Suddenly, a customer walked in. He was a tall, bearded man covered in tattoos. I could see he had a gun in his holster at his hip. I live in Arizona, so carrying a gun is legal here, but it always makes me uncomfortable. I smiled at him, but he just walked right past me without saying anything. I waited at my counter for the rest of my shift, but he never came back. No other customers came in or out. It was just him, and I had no idea where he went. I was ready to close up for the day, but I couldn't do that if I thought he was still in the store. I nervously walked through the aisles, looking everywhere for him. I even checked inside the bathrooms, but I couldn't find him. I didn't know what else to do. I was genuinely scared. I called out, "Hello? Is anybody still here?" My voice echoed throughout the empty store. I hated that I was alone. I hated that the man had a gun. I knew for a fact that I saw him come in, but I never saw him leave. I also knew that there were no other exits besides the doors in the front. But even though I didn't have an explanation for where the man went, I had to close up. So I turned off all the lights and checked that all the registers were locked. Then I left through the front and locked the doors behind me. I tried to sleep that night, but I couldn't. I kept thinking about that man. The next day, I called my coworker who was on the morning shift and asked if anything was out of the ordinary at the store. She told me no, everything was normal. I felt relieved, even though I still had paranoid thoughts in the back of my mind. That night, I went back for another shift. Thankfully, there was another coworker with me, so I wasn't completely alone. Just before closing, I was helping one of our last customers. My coworker Lacey was somewhere in the back, and as the customer was leaving, three more men walked in, all with guns on their hips. They walked with the same kind of angry determination as the man before.
I nervously greeted them, but just like before, they pretended I wasn't there. I watched them disappear down the aisles. A few minutes later, Lacey came back to the registers and I asked her if she'd seen anyone in the back. She said she hadn't, no one was here. I told her about the three men I had just seen, plus the man from yesterday, and my coworker's eyes widened. "Oh my God," she muttered. "We were supposed to close up in about 5 minutes, so we had to get to the bottom of this." Together, we walked around the empty store. I was too afraid to leave her side. We didn't find any signs of the three men. When we got to the meat section in the back, Lacey froze. She pointed toward the door behind the freezer. "Did you look in there?" she asked. There was a back room where we kept all the frozen meat. It was the only place I forgot to look. Lacey held my hand and together we walked toward the door. When we got close enough, I put my ear against the door, and sure enough, I could hear voices inside. I pulled out my phone to call 911, but before I could start the call, Lacey had already pushed the door open. That was a huge mistake. Inside were six men, the three I'd just seen, the man from the night before, and two others. They were all big and bearded, sitting around a table. All the frozen meat was still dangling around them. But I could feel that the refrigerator had been turned off. The room was warm and smelly. This was some sort of neo-Nazi group having a meeting in the back of Target. They saw us right away. The man from yesterday stood up and charged towards us.
"This is a private meeting," he said.
Then he shoved us both back and slammed the door in our faces. Lacey and I both ran out of the building and called 911. We were frantic. The police came very quickly and Lacey told them what we'd found. I was too scared to speak. One officer stayed with us to calm us down while several more walked into the store, guns ready. We waited for a long time. Everything was silent. Then we heard gunshots. The officer who had stayed with us told us to stay where we were. Then he walked inside too. We heard more gunshots. I think I was crying, but Lacey's expression was totally blank. She looked like she was in shock. Nothing happened for a long time, until the front door opened and one of the men ran out, bleeding from his shoulder. He raced towards us, glaring with pure hatred, and said, "This isn't over. I'll find you." Then he disappeared into the night. More police came pretty soon after. That's when we found out what happened. There was a huge gunfight inside. All the bearded men had been killed except for that one man. Along with the dead bodies left in the store, there were several homemade explosives and maps of the store with little red X's. Obviously, they had plans to blow up the Target. I quit the next day. I had no idea why those men decided to gather at my store. I didn't know what their big plan was. All I know is that at least one of them is still out there, and he knows who I am.